is remarkable. He comes up towards the winning line under Davy Russell to win his second Randox Health Grand National.
Desert Orchid, watch history being made. Roars of applause. The king's in his counting house.
Heading down towards the last fight in the champion hurdle, and it's Annie Power comes towards it now. She's about four lengths clear. Viziosi jumped it perfectly.
Hello and welcome along to another episode of From the Horse's Mouth. The lockdown continues, but the light at the end of the tunnel shines a little brighter. With plans for racing's return in the not-so-distant future, it seems. We discuss those plans with this week's guest, Jason Weaver, who also takes on Ruby's quiz. We've got Raw Egg Challenges, part two of the Mike Joyce interview. We saw a star on Racing Gold, and we've got tips for a superb card at Sha Tin. All that and more straight from the horse's mouth. Hello and welcome to another edition of From the Horse's Mouth. 24th of April, still socially distancing, but I'm delighted to be joined once again by my great friends Ruby Walsh and a tuxedoed Paddy Power.
Tom, do you feel left out, do you?
I feel like I didn't get the heads up on dressing up for Fridays.
No, I thought we were like, you know, I mean, a team. This podcast was going well. We're all in it together. And then Paddy discovers there's such a thing as Dress Up Friday. He dresses up and never tells the rest of us. I mean, it's just, thank God this is only audio.
It does look like a very expensive dicky bow, to be fair. It's not one of the cheap, just clip-on
ones. It's one you tie yourself, you know what I mean? You learn in posh school how to do.
Lads, this is slightly awkward because, you know, Tom introduced us great friends. I mean, I'd say, yeah, we'd be maybe friends, I guess, but like, great. You would be my podcast friends.
Yeah, it's just as well we're both getting paid, Ruby, isn't it?
And good job, I'd hang up otherwise.
Anyway, back to matters at hand. Light is indeed appearing at the end of the tunnel. France and Germany, France in particular, working towards an early May start for racing to come back. The UK making plans, which we'll come to talk about later. But in Ireland, Ruby, big announcement, 5th of May is the deadline for whether restrictions will be changed or not. And the talk is that racing will be ready to come back in Ireland at kind of 10 days notice. Is that right?
I'd say at the most, Tom, I'd say ready to go even sooner than that if it was allowed. But look, Irish Racing will do whatever the government suggests it should do. It has the framework in place. It already has had 10 meetings behind closed doors. It knows exactly what it has to do, how to run them. It knows what's required. So as soon as the government are happy to allow racing to recommence or to start again, it will, and is ready to do it. And with the experience it gained before the lockdown in how many people you could cut out, get it right down to the bare essentials, to the minimum amount of people required, Irish Racing's in a good place to restart whenever the government sees fit.
Well, the BHA came out during the weekend and announced that as a measure to reduce any potential stress on NHS from injured jockeys or any kind of incidents, they'd cap runners and jockeys to 12 in each race, and there'd be a preference towards using senior jockeys and a senior jockey turned pundit. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now is Jason Weaver. Hey Jason, how are you doing?
I'm in great form, thanks lads. Great for you to have me on.
No problem at all. Thanks for coming on and joining us. Tell us a little bit more. Maybe we're probably, it could be rightly accused of being a little bit Irish-centric, but tell us what the lie of the land is in the UK at the moment and with a view to kind of the return of sport and racing and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we got a bit of a rap over here, didn't we, for stopping earlier, whereas in Ireland they kept going and they had a fantastic template in place, which was probably, I would imagine, that they had from connection from Hong Kong, Australia, those sort of places where racing has continued. And then again, you look as if you may well jump ahead of us when racing gets underway again, and we can slot on your tail, hopefully around about a week after. But again, it's a big guess.
Ruby, the 12 jockey and runner limit, is that a good move, do you think? Is that a sensible thing to do in the UK, and could you see something similar happening in Ireland as well?
I think it's probably a good idea in the beginning, because it definitely would make social distancing a bit easier. I'd just be interested to see what Jason thinks. What do they mean by senior riders? Is that just taking apprentices out of the equation? Or will that be done on an age thing or the amount of rides you had? What do you call a senior jockey?
I can only imagine. I'm guessing a little bit the same as you, but it's got to be somebody, possibly the cutoff point would be £3 claim or have lost your claim. I don't know if that is what is required. And if there's just 12 runners and we're under a sort of a lockdown situation, who is everybody absolutely satisfied having riding their horses? They got a whole load of hurdles to get over before that. But I would say that it would mean jockeys, not apprentices.
Jason, on a lighter note, how have you been spending your time? Have you been using it wisely? Have you been learning a language? Have you been doing press-ups? See, what's that paint? Creosote?
That's wood stain up the arm, because I've been painting the house on my lockdown, and I was absolutely flying. Everything was going great. Did the outside of the house, worked my way in, down the stairs, hit a brick wall when I thought we weren't going to get back racing early enough. Led on the couch, drank far too much for a while, got a little bit down on myself like you do, and then I've sort of give myself a kick up the arse and said, right, come on, let's look for some sort of hope.
And of course, the hope you've been building towards is taking on Ruby Walsh in today's quiz, because that is the pinnacle of anybody's career, is getting the opportunity to take on basically sport's answer to Einstein. Are you confident? Would you consider yourself a good table quizzer?
I think I'm going to let myself down here, but I'd consider myself a good guesser. I'm a good guesser.
Good so guesser.
I like it. I like in some of the questions I heard yesterday anyway,
okay,
from previous contests. Listen, if it's Krypton Factor, I'm in trouble. If it's good guessing, I'm okay.
Well, it's always better to be lucky than good. We'll give you the honour of choosing, Jason. Would you like the old course or the new course of questions?
New course.
The new course. Very good. Right, well, we'll start with you. First question is on racing. In 2008, there was no racing on the Wednesday of the Cheltenham Festival because of high winds during the night. But who won the Arkle a day earlier that year? Now I can give you...
Sorry, no chance. Absolutely no chance.
Do you want a clue?
Go on.
The trainer's first name is Howard.
Howard Johnson won it. I only remember, believe it or not, schooling for Howard Johnson when I was an apprentice. And I went out through the side of a wooden wing, going up the side of a field. And I thought, think I'm going to go on a diet. I have no idea.
Ruby, do you know what it was?
I think it was Tidal Bay, was it?
It was. Tidal Bay is correct. Right, Ruby, first question, old course. In which year was Royal Ascot held at York to allow refurbishments to take place at the Berkshire track?
Fran Berry won the Ascot Stakes for Tony Martin. 2005.
Very good. Correct. 2005, 1-0. Was that a guess or did you know?
I knew.
The question number two, Jason, sports. Who announces departure from his job as the manager of the England women's football team this week?
Phil Neville,
correct and right. 1-1. Ruby, second question for you. Joe Burrow was the headline act in which annual American sporting tradition? And I can give you a clue if you want.
Well, it wasn't the Super Bowl, but I don't know. Sporting tradition is still on, like. It was on this week or was it on six months ago?
Yeah, it was on this week. It was on last night.
Sporting tradition that was on last night. Well, they cancelled the tomato fight in Spain. What would the American sporting tradition? What do you call him again?
Joe Burrow, the great Joe Burrow.
What was he great at?
He's a very good quarterback.
So then was it like, what do you call the thing they do for the hurling? Puck fodder? Was it something to do with throwing the ball?
No. I'm pulling the rug out from under you now. No, you're going on too long. He was the first pick in the NFL draft last night.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, you as being a sports radio presenter should be staying across all these things.
I was all over the basketball draft for the last dance. Forgot about the NFL one.
One all still. Jason, final question. Who, perhaps surprisingly, was revealed as the secretive donor of £250,000 to a fund in aid of independent bookshops?
No. And it... Go on.
No. I'll let you muddle away if you can figure it out.
Howdy.
The clue is, it's named after a South American river.
Geography. No, I'm rubbish, lad. Sorry.
No, that's okay. The answer we were looking for was Amazon. Amazon, made to try and do some
trying to get himself out of the PR. Hole after getting keeping his workers in there.
Exactly. He gave $250,000. Good old Jeff Bezos. Ruby, this is to win it. How are you feeling?
I feel it's going to be a tiebreaker.
Confident.
Which world famous school striker spoke out on Earth Day to call for a combined effort to tackle coronavirus and the climate crisis?
Oh.
What's her name?
T. Second name begins with T. Thorpe.
No more clues, Tom. No more clues.
She's only young.
Only a kid. Yeah. I know.
Are you going to admit that you just say you don't know it? Yeah?
I don't know.
Okay.
I do know it, but I can't think of it.
Jason, what's her name?
Greta Thunberg.
Correct, but sadly you don't get the point. So we go to a tiebreaker. One all in an absolute thriller here. The tiebreaker. Ruby, you're to go first here. In which year did the Republic of Ireland last beat England at football?
So they were going to beat them when the English fans went to Lula in Dublin and wrecked the stadium.
That's not the question.
Last beat England in a soccer match. I can't even remember the last time they played England in a soccer match.
Do you want to give me a guess or do you want to keep waffling? 1998. Jason Weaver, same question to you. The nearest answer wins. Ruby Wallace says 1998 was the last year the Republic of Ireland beat England at association football.
Okay, so I being a Welshman, I've very little interest in the England football team anyway, but I'll go one lower.
And that is good enough to win it because the correct answer was 1988. There's been 6 draws in the intervening period. Jason Weaver, I'm delighted to congratulate you on your great victory over Ruby Walsh. And he now officially owes you £20.
We love that.
Yeah.
Of course you do. Welsh man. Can't wait to get it off me.
Spend it wisely. It might buy you another can of paint for the house or something like that. And before you go, one flat horse maybe to keep an eye on when racing does eventually come back. Have you got anything for us?
Yeah, I have actually. I've got 2 horses that I've, you know, and not yet, but everybody's going, oh, Mogul will have a great chance in all the big races and everything else. But there's a couple of horses, one for Alan King called Tritonic, who he won the Haynes Hansen and Clark at Newbury. And he looked really, really good. And then he actually bombed quite badly in the Zetland up at Newmarket. And I think he's underestimated on a mark of 93, Tritonic. So he's got a bit of room for manoeuvre. And a horse who's changed stable from last year to this, horse called Almania, who was with Sir Michael Stout. On his first start as a 3-year-old, he ran him in the Dante. So he was obviously his Derby horse. he had a load of four or five races, I think it is, after that, and he never actually got any luck in all of those races. He finds himself on a tricky mark of 95, but David Simcock, who's my next door neighbour, he's got him now, and I think he's just the type that'll suit Spencer sitting on him when he gets back from his broken hip, just taking his time and coming through. So sort of two horses, I think, they're high up there. They're good horses, you know, 93 and 95, but I think they've got a good room for a bit of manoeuvre.
What a pro. Didn't even tell him that question was coming, but he had two in the bank ready to go. Jason Weaver, you're a gentleman. Thank you very much for joining us.
Lads, thank you very much.
See you, Jason.
Cheers, Jay.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
This week on Why the Long Face, instead of actually doing a Why the Long Face, we're going to have a little pivot away. And as these chain mails of challenges and different things to raise money for good causes, we've decided to take on the Raw Egg Challenge. Paddy Power is a health guru. I'd imagine this is something that you've probably done on a number of occasions.
No, I've never done the I don't know what the health benefit would be. I do eat plenty of eggs. But probably too many eggs, actually. But I don't know why raw eggs are better for you than poached eggs or whatever. Like, I mean, I'm sure like fried eggs, if you fry them in loads of butter, are bad.
And Ruby, you've decided to veto the challenge on health grounds.
On health grounds, yeah. Because I don't have a spleen, I'm advised not to take anything that's unpasteurized, which a raw egg is, like drinking unpasteurized milk. So my good wife, who looks after my health, has advised me against this one. Strongly advised me, actually.
Producer Ollie is going to join us on this one as well. We'll have to make a donation. Paddy, who do you want to donate to? Do you want to donate a fiver?
Do it for Dan.
Do it for Dan. Let's do it for Dan again.
Do it for Dan. And we'll put the link into the episode description as well for Do for Dan. Okay, I'm going to crack my egg into my glass here. I don't know if you can hear that.
We did hear that. It sounds like you got a very strong egg. Sounds like
the egg is all over the table. I'm going to do a commentary on this. Paddy is cracking his egg into what looks to be... Are you separating the egg from the white, Paddy?
I didn't want to spill the egg, whatever the left excess it's egg on my desk. Right. I'm not in the kitchen. Do you know what I mean? We'll go on three,
lads. Tom, you're cheating. What are you putting in the egg?
I'm just opening water. I have water beside me because I reckon I'm going to need it badly afterwards.
To wash it down. That's not about that. Paddy, can you stop talking for a minute, please? This is your money part of this show. I'm in control of this pack.
Hang on. I've got a bit of shell in there that I'm just taking out. Right, I'm ready.
On three, lads. One, two, three. Tom has it down the hatch straight away. Paddy had the cheers, everybody. Ollie looks like he's struggling, but it's in. Paddy's a swallower.
That was spit. Jesus.
That wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Was it? It wasn't that bad.
Eggs are nice. It's just not a nice way to eat an egg. Do you know what I mean?
You didn't eat it. You just drank it.
Well, do you know what I mean? Like, so now I've got an egg in me and I didn't enjoy eating it. It was just like it's in there. But the whole point of eating is enjoying your food, isn't it?
Bet you never thought you'd say, at least I have an egg in me.
Do it for Dan. Check out the link in the episode description. And next week, we might be back with Why the Long Face.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
Next up is part two of our pre-recorded interview with LA-based TV presenter Mike Joyce. Mike works for US Racing Network TVG and filled us in on how Wesley Ward's two-year-old's become so fast, but also shed some light on one of the biggest scandals to hit US racing in many years.
So basically, I'll tell you this about Jorge Navarro and Jason Service. I've never personally met Jason Service. Our paths just never crossed. I never interviewed him. And I'd interviewed Jorge Navarro a couple times, who I actually liked. I mean, the guy's straight out of Central Casting. If you're like, hey, I need someone to play, you know, Pablo Escobar in the upcoming movie about the Medellin cartel, you're like, I got him. He trains horses down in Florida. His name's Jorge. You're perfect. But I don't want to say everyone knew they were cheating, but everyone knew they were cheating. I mean, it was you know, Jason Service went from a nondescript, you know, low-level blue-collar trainer to, you know, the highest percentage trainer in the world. And then Jorge Navarro kind of burst onto the scene about a half a decade ago. And, you know, he beats Todd Pletcher down at Gulfstream Park, which was unthinkable. And he gets a training title. And everyone knew, and it wasn't the fact that they were winning at such a high clip that was really the telltale signs, because I think a lot of people forget that, you know, you can have trainers finish up a meet winning at 30% and not be cheating. And especially at, you know, a place like Monmouth Park, where they were running against shorter fields and they would have the 4-5 favorite. Well, it's like, if you're running a 4-5 shot in a 5-horse field every time, you're going to win a good percentage of your races. I don't think that was a telltale sign. I think the telltale sign is when they have these horses running absolutely impossible performances, right? When Chancelot won at Saratoga, the horse ran faster than any horse in the history of the planet. And I mean, I remember watching that race and I'm like, if this horse isn't on drugs, I'm a 10-foot blue alien, right? I mean, we all kind of saw it. Like, we all saw it was there. We knew it. It was more obvious than here in the US when all these, you know, baseball players put on 35 pounds of muscle and started hitting 60 home runs a year, right? I mean, it was the performances and horses doing what horses aren't supposed to do. And, you know, even though we all knew it, there was nothing we could really do about it, right? Because they were ahead of the testing. They had substances that were completely unbeknownst to any regulatory authority. I mean, they were passing, you know, blood tests, urine tests, hair tests. They were passing everything. And they had a masking agent that was essentially perfect. And I still, even now that they've discovered the masking agent, I doubt that labs have figured out a way to get around it. So they had, you know, the best product in the world. And the other thing is it took the FBI a year-long investigation, including wiretaps and informants. And I mean, this is a federal law enforcement authority. This is one of the best law enforcement authorities in the world. And it took them a year of investigating to figure it out and to catch these guys. So it was very intricate. It was very big. And it was, you know, it was as big and dramatic as anything as you can imagine in this game. And there are statements that the investigations are ongoing. But I would suspect there are some bigger names in the thoroughbred industry that had partaken and had been in contact with. So I wonder if there's another shoe to drop here somewhere along the lines. But basically, I mean, it wasn't shocking, the two people that it was. If you had to guess, okay, there's two people in thoroughbred racing that are cheating, you give me their names, you know, just give me a guess, you know, for, you know, like, and you can only say two. I think everybody would have said those two. I think everybody would have been like, okay, it's Jason Service and it's Jorge Navarro. So it was all very obvious. You know, as a broadcaster and a reporter, there's nothing we can do about it when it's happening, even though we see it and it's so obvious, because if we do say something and then, you know, there's libel and slander law that we could be taken to task for. Then, you know, the next thing everyone's talking about is the pandemic and we're all in lockdown. And this thing's kind of, you know, been forgotten about because people are just trying to get day to day. So it's a crazy story. It's a crazy saga. I'm glad that those two were caught. And you know, if nothing else, you know, I hope they go to jail and I hope it's nothing personal against those two, but I think we need a tremendous deterrent against cheaters in this game, because as you know, and I'm sure they deal with it everywhere, that is one of the biggest problems for people who put their hard earned money up. They don't want to think that what they're betting on is predetermined, or what they're betting on, they don't have a shot against, because there's people there who are untoward and taking advantage.
Yes, very interesting. We'll be watching that story unfold as time goes on. Mike, a lot of UK and Irish racing fans, their summer is punctuated by Wesley Ward rolling into town for Royal Ascot with a couple of 5 furlong horses on the turf. Does that look unlikely now? Travel restrictions looks more likely than not, right?
They do. It's, you know, in the US, you have to remember we're 50 different states, and we're 50 different fiefdoms, right? And that, I think that actually does take, you know, come into play with international travel as well. It's where you're flying from as much as where you're, you know, flying to. You know, they have different standards that they got to apply to. So it might not be so much, you know, going into England, right? Or going over the Atlantic. It might be coming back, right? If I got to bring my horse back to Kentucky, what are the standards here? And those are changing constantly. And, you know, we'll have to see it, you know, go. By the way, I will say this about Wesley Ward, and I'll give you guys just an insight as to one of my favorite Wesley stories as to why his horses are so good at age two and why they're also so fast. Todd Pletcher was telling the story. Palm Meadows Training Center is, you know, offsite from Gulfstream Park. And there was a race day where Todd had some horses in, but then he had to go back to Palm Meadows for something. And he goes back there, and Wesley had like 4 horses running at Gulfstream that day. He didn't see him at the track. And he comes back to Palm Meadows. It's the middle of the afternoon, where usually training is in the morning hours. And he sees Wesley Ward there on a folding chair with his feet up on a cooler, you know, knocking back like a beer or whatever, maybe it was a water, who knows what it was. Shirt off, just sitting there with the starter button, holding the starter button with the starting gate in front of him, with just teams of 2-year-olds going in by pairs and just popping them out of there. Come in, pop out, come in. He's like, he must have popped, you know, 14 2-year-olds out of there in 5 minutes. Just bring them in, pop them out, bring them in, pop them out. He trains every single one of his horses to be fast. He trains every single one of his horses to get out of the gate. And that's why they all went early, because there is no horse better prepared for the start of a race than a Wesley Ward 2-year-old. And when you're only going 5 furlongs, that's a huge edge. It's a huge edge. So that's one of the reasons he's had success everywhere. And he's, you know, it's brilliant. It's worked out well for him throughout his career. And he's one of the more brilliant trainers we have here in the States.
Before I let you go, Mike, when racing returns in its former glory, give us one name to follow stateside just through the season that might be worth following.
Oh God, there's a lot of them I want to say right now. I'll tell you what, I just interviewed him on my podcast yesterday or a couple of days ago, Doug O'Neill. So he had a horse named Four Left that won the thousand guineas at Maidan in preparation for the UAE Derby. And the thing I love about Doug is that he's really honest if his horses have limitations. He said, look, we really wanted to go into the UAE Derby. He's like, I don't know if this horse can get a mile and a quarter. But the reason that stuck in my head is because about 10 years ago, he had a horse named Golden Sense that won the Santa Anita Derby at a mile and an eighth and then ran in the Kentucky Derby. And then he stopped on that horse and brought him back as a sprinter and started running him like 3/4, you know, 6-7 furlongs. And he turned that horse into a sprinter and then a dirt miler. And the horse won 2 Breeders' Cup Dirt Miles. So when Doug says, he's one of the only trainers that would have done that, because I think many trainers, if they have a grade one winner at 9 furlongs, they're going to keep that horse going 2 turns, right? No matter what. But he thinks outside the box. So I would like to see what they do with Four Left coming back. It's a J. Paul Redham horse. I think he's one that when racing returns, I think you're going to see him off the classic distances. And I want to know if they turn him back into a sprinter or if they turn him into like a dirt miler and they go the way of Golden Sense with him.
That was, of course, part two of our Mike Joyce interview. Mike presents the TVG podcast, which you can find on all good podcast platforms. Basically, wherever you found us, his podcast will be there as well. And Four Left is the horse to keep an eye out for with Doug O'Neill. But in the meantime, the From the Horse's Mouth Book Club is back with a bang. And we basically were told to hurry up by our producer. So we were given 2 chapters this week as opposed to just one. What I find very interesting is probably the dynamic with Willie, because chapter 5 is just called Willie. And maybe there was probably more about other things in the chapter than there was about Willie. But I think that relationship is probably something that intrigues me the most. What was that like? As a young fella, and was he always kind of harsh but fair? Because you talk about him coming back into the parade ring after riding a winner, but not really riding to his instructions. But there was no quiet word afterwards. It was just big smile, well done, you knew what you were doing kind of thing.
He put a lot of trust in me as a jockey. And obviously the older I got, the more trust he put in me. But it was, I suppose I had changed tactics that day and made the running on something when there was no pace. But I think he liked that the plan we had beforehand wasn't what transpired on the track. So I changed and adapted to what was going on in front of me. And that was another string to my bow that he liked that I was going to do that. But there was obviously times then, Tom, when you would change tactics and it didn't work. So you had to come in and take the blame those days. And I wasn't afraid to do that either. But I always felt that if the trainer trained the horse and he had to have trust in the jockey when he went out to ride him in that he was going to do the right thing or at least try and do the right thing. No one can do the right thing all the time. But if you were trying to do the right thing, people tended to back you up.
Willie had a massive influence on your decision to turn professional. Is that fair?
He had, but like, you're saying the first time I was champion amateur, I was in school. So I would go to school every Thursday knowing that I wasn't going to be there for the last 4 classes. And I'd get picked up at lunchtime and go to Turles or Clonmel or wherever the racing was on. And you know, I was in school, but I was living an adult life while still in school with students. It was a bit surreal, but it was really enjoyable. And yeah, I left school and or finished school and then was champion amateur again. And then it was a crossroads. Do you turn professional? Do you stay amateur? You know, I think Dad had definitely advised me to turn pro, and so did Willie. And you're going to need backing of people to turn professional. And I had the backing of Dad, and I was lucky enough to get the backing of Willie, and I never looked back. But it was a big decision at the time.
Overnight, when you made that decision, what are the initial changes?
Obviously, as an amateur, you're predominantly riding against amateurs as well. And in Ireland, that meant basically riding in the bumpers. So I could have 21 outside rides through the year in professional races over jumps. I could ride horses owned by my mother in as many races as I so wished. So I went from probably having 30, 35 rides a year over jumps and riding the rest in bumpers on the flat to turning professional and riding solely over jumps, because in Ireland, a professional can't ride in the bumper. So I went from basically riding on the flat to riding over jumps overnight. And you're also was the competition. I was moving in to compete against Conor O'Dwyer and Charlie Swan, Paul Carberry. Barry Geraghty was the same age as me, but they were the three predominant jockeys at the time. So, you know, I was at the top as an amateur, and I was going in then to take on the top lads as professionals as well.
Did you know you were good? I mean, you're winning amateur 2 years in a row, and then you win. Did you win the title your first year as a pro as well?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, but
yeah. So did you know at that stage you going like, geez, I'm actually pretty good at this, or are you kind of going, geez, I'm so lucky I'm with Willie Mullins, or what way is your head working at that stage when you're a kid?
That way. To be like, Willie had been champion amateur himself as a jockey the year before he retired. So then he retired and I became champion amateur, basically riding the majority of Willie Mullins' bumper horses. So it was the horses you were getting on. So I was lucky enough to get that job, and I was champion amateur twice. Then when I turned professional, Willie didn't have, he wasn't as big a yard as he is now, but I was lucky in that I got to ride most of Francis Crowley's, Willie's, and my dad had more horses at the time as well. So I had three good yards behind me, and I got the opportunities. But you needed the opportunities. I think I rode 96 winners that year. But you needed the horses. And I was lucky enough to be in yards that were going upwards. They were all getting bigger, all getting stronger, and I was coming with them.
So when you're there, your first or second or third year, whatever, as a pro, and as you said, you're competing with Conor O'Dwyer and Charlie Swan and Paul Carberry, and you're probably picking up rides ahead of them, right? At some stage, that starts happening where they ring Ruby before they ring Charlie Swan or whatever. From Charlie Swan's perspective, he must be going, oh, Jesus. And as I wanted to ask you, does that happen to you at the end of your career? Because there's always talk about the last couple of years, and oh, it's Paul Tennant, he's going to take over from Ruby. Like, was there ever that you're thinking, like, Jesus, what happens if they get Paul to ride this? Or did that not come into it?
No, of course that comes into it. But that's the same in every sport. There's always someone coming behind you that you're always trying to stay ahead of. Always. And I did, I suppose, in the start of my career, I got chances. I got on Imperial Call in Punchestown in the Irish Gold Cup. AP was riding Doan's Pride. Richard Johnson, or Richard O'Muddy, even was riding Florida Pearl. I suppose Charlie was coming to the end of his career. He nearly stopped riding over fences by then. I think I only rode in one chase with him. Yeah, you were getting opportunities, but I definitely came and saw the Barry Geraghty at a time where there was an opening. Charlie was just on the way out, and there was an opening that we were able to fill into. And yeah, to answer your other question, coming to the end of my career, I'd only came to the end of my career. All through my career, you were looking over your shoulder at the opposition, trying to stay ahead of them so that they didn't get on your rides. No one is contracted in racing. Any trainer, any day, or any owner, any day, can use the best available every day. So that fear was always there. And I don't think it was a bad thing. It definitely kept you on your toes.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
The year was 2009. Swine flu was declared a global pandemic. Barack Obama moved into the White House, and we were at the beginning of a pretty bleak recession. But on Newmarket's Rolly Mile, we saw a star.
And See the Stars is running on well. It's evasive in front. He's starting to wander. See the Stars racing to him on the near side. And Delegator on the far side has raced through as well. Delegator takes it up clearly now. See the Stars comes at him. They settle down to fight it out as they hit the rising ground. Delegator and See the Stars. See the Stars going home slightly the better. And See the Stars wins the Giddies for John Ox and Mick Cannan. Delegator second. Tight third.
Yes, the unmistakable tones of Aussie Jim. They're calling home See the Stars in the 2009-2000 Guineas. The first win, Paddy, in a pretty remarkable year and season and probably career as well.
Yeah, I loved, absolutely loved See the Stars. And I don't know if it's something to do with the, this is the terrible thing about me again. I backed on that. It was double, it was about 10 to 1, I think, wasn't it? 9 or 10 to 1 for the Guineas. I think it was a decent price anyway. But I think I backed on that day. And kind of got behind. I loved the way he was. I know John Ox wasn't a small trainer, and Mick Cannan's obviously a legend, but up against the bigger, some of the bigger stables that have pacemakers and loads of runners and races and stuff like that, I always felt like he was just, he always had enough just to get himself. When he proved that throughout his career, that he'd never be hugely impressive, like running away by 10 lengths, but he'd always get up and beat whoever was put in front of him. And I think the culmination, like the Guineas was great and everything like that, but that was just the start of things to come. And the culmination was when he won the Ark and he came through all sorts of traffic trouble under Mick Cannan. You thought he was absolutely beat and he came through and won again. I thought, you know, I don't know if it'll never be proven, so I can probably just say it anyway, even though most people disagree with me. I think he was better than Frankel. I think he's the best I've ever seen. And the reason why I'd say that is because he tried more. He went different trips and he travelled and he did all sorts of things that Frankel didn't do. There's nothing wrong with Frankel now, but I just absolutely loved See the Star. I think he was brilliant.
Ruby, we often talk about National Hunt horses capturing the public's imagination. But for a flat horse that only ran 9 times and maybe arguably, despite winning Group 2, I think, as a 2-year-old, probably had a low-key enough 2-year-old career, but really... By the time he made it to Paris in the autumn, he had, the whole world was watching him, really, wasn't he? He was one of those flat horses that really just kind of captured the imagination.
He was. I mean, he obviously won a maiden in Leopardstown as a 2-year-old. He got beat the first time in the Curragh, and then he won the Beresfords after he won his maiden. But he didn't go through the winter, the talking horse, the talking 3-year-old. And he went to the Curragh or to Newmarket even, as we just heard there, slightly under the radar. People thinking a mile would probably be sharp enough for him. But he got the job done. And it's just, it was the voyage he went on from there. He went from there to Epsom, where he won the Derby at 1.5 miles, dropped back to win the Eclipse at 1.25 miles. You know, he'd won 3 Group 1s in May, June and July at 3 different trips. And straight away, he was capturing your imagination. Like, he'd won the 3 of them in England. He then went and won the Judmont, was 4. He came to Leopardstown and won the Champion Stakes 5, which was in Ireland, and then went to France 6. It was the travelling, it was the variation in trips. He was just an incredible horse.
What you loved about it was how fearless they were, because it's one of the most frustrating things about the flat particularly is the protection of stud value, if you like. So people being afraid to get beat, so afraid to try things. And I just loved, it's just so, and it's the same with jumps as well, to be fair, seeing horses take on other big horses, like, and try different trips and try new things as well, and just to see and just to try and get to the bottom of how good they are. The connections of the horse, obviously, we're on this like fairy tale ride saying like, geez, this is the horse of a lifetime, let's just beat the best in the world and let's just go and beat everyone. And I love that, rather than, okay, right, we've already got a brilliant miler, so let's make him our mile and two horse, a 1.5 miles horse from some of the bigger up, like the Dolphin or Coolmore might do that. But I think I love that. I love the fact that he was fearless.
Better than Frankel, Ruby?
It's a big statement. I mean, you watch some of Frankel's performance and you think, oh my God, the Guineas and Newmarket, the James's Palace, even his Queen Anne win. But what See the Stars did that Frankel didn't do was travel. Whereas See the Stars had to be gotten up in the middle of the night to be brought to Newmarket to win the Guineas, and the same thing to go to for Epsom. Probably spent the night in Paris before he won the Prix de l'Arc. You know, he'd get on an aeroplane, go and do it. Whereas Frankel, they were all just horse box trips. And, you know, Frankel never won an away game. See the Stars won plenty of them.
He did indeed. And as Jim McGrath said in his call of the arc, perfection in equine form, the horse of a lifetime. See the Stars was this week's Racing Gold.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
Delighted to be joined on the line once again by our in-house Asian racing enthusiast, Connor Murphy. Connor, how are you? Thanks a million for joining us.
No problem. Lovely to be here again, Tom.
All eyes to Hong Kong this weekend. Very good card in Sha Tin. We're going to take a look at some of the feature races and you're going to give us a steer. QE2 Cup, talk us through it.
Yeah, it's not an original take here. It's a pretty poor race, but I think Exultant is going to be really hard to beat. He's really hard to get away from. Zach Purton really has this race in his hands. What he wants to do early on, I think, is going to set the tone for it. It's probably the field that's been hit by the lack of international runners more than anything. A lot of the time, you get a good few Japanese runners in here. Like last year, we'd win Bright. He beat Exultant, and he beat Lee Scrissieu, who went on to win the Cox Plate. So it's a pretty marked step down to the quality that we have this year, and it's quite easy to see why Exultance is expected to do it. Time Warp is just so unpredictable. He needs to lead. He's really difficult to catch right. Ferrore is going to be his other big rival here. I think he's really flattered to deceive. He's a horse I've fallen out of love with. He's done very little since he won the Derby last year. And look, there is two biggest rivals, and Exultant doesn't have to do much to win this. I think the only slight worry is there is a little lack of pace on here. Like, Time Warp has to lead, like I said, but he showed he is pretty lethal if they leave him to it. Last time in the Gold Cup, Moreira just got his fractions right. Everyone else, including Zach Purton on Exultant, just left him to it. Exultant flew home. It was a gut-wrenching defeat, to be honest, for his supporters. He was beaten just a half length, and it was a hard one to watch. I don't think he's quick enough at this age to get away with that over 10 furlongs, and Purton just needs to be a little more forward in him this time. If he wants to sit second or third, he's drawn just outside Time Warp, so he should be okay to do it. I'd give a little mention to Playa del Puente as well. Ran a massive surprise in the Derby. He was second. He probably was flattered a bit, but I wouldn't rule out the 10 furlongs being a little more up his street than a mile that he's usually been racing at. But look, all things considered, it's Zach Purton to lose on Exultant. He's by far the best horse in the race, and hopefully we'll see that on Sunday morning.
Lovely stuff. Champions Mile, Connor.
This is one I found really hard. It's a real head versus heart one. I'm a massive fan of Waikuku here. It's a bit of a two-horse race, as it has been kind of all season in this division. Waikuku and Beauty Generation. I'm in little doubt Waikuku is the better horse, and he has the potential to be a very good miler going forward. But my head has just turned me towards Beauty Generation for this one last time. I think whatever happens, it's going to be a race to savor. This is very likely to be Beauty Generation's last start in Hong Kong. There's a bit of a change happening in Hong Kong. John Moore, who's been the leading trainer there for 20-odd years, is relocating down to Australia. He said he might take Beauty Generation with him, but it's up to the owners whether they want to keep him in Hong Kong or retire him. It's pretty likely this is going to be his last go in Sha Tin. It's pretty hard to make a case that he is as good as he once was. He's probably a few pounds below his peak rate in a 1.27, even though he has won a Group 1 this year. He lost for the first time in, I think it was 10 starts, the streak was back in October, and he lost three times subsequently, all of those at the hands of Waikuku. The Chairman's Trophy run, though, from 3 weeks ago, I think is the real one to zone in on here. It wasn't anything special from Beauty Generation. He just won a kind of a snug half length. That seems to be his mantra these days. Waikuku's run, though, was a huge red flag. Like, he came off a break there. John Size, his trainer, was saying he will come on from the run. There'll be some fitness improvement off him, but he was just beaten way too early and way too easily for that to be purely down to fitness. And I think he is still feeling the effects of a couple of hard races the far side of his break. If you go back to last season, he faded massively in April as well. There were two really poor performances off the back of a hard season, and I think we may just have to wait to see the best of Waikuku. That'll probably be next season. But Beauty Generation, he's no problem stringing these runs together. He took 8 races in his stride last year, winning every single one of them, including this race. And he's very hardened. He knows exactly what to do. This is going to be his third win, hopefully, in the Champions Mile, and we'll set him on his way to Australia or wherever he goes to in his next chapter.
Last race we're going to take a look at the Chantin is the Chairman's Sprint. Connor, talk us through this one.
Yeah, this is such an interesting race. I have a real soft spot for a Tiro here. I think he could be one of the most naturally talented horses you would see anywhere in the world. And this race just revolves around them. Will he jump out of the gates properly this time is the big question. He had a massive reputation going into the Hong Kong Sprint back in December. It was pretty lofty, but fairly well deserved in my eyes. He ran okay. Like, he got collared late by Hot King Prawn, who reopposes and beat the clock that day. Afterwards, it came out that he had a bit of a fever and he had a few niggling issues as well that just kept him on the sidelines. He made his reappearance there 3 weeks ago, and that run is far harder to forgive, believe me. He just blew the start completely, pulled so hard. He looked like a spoiled brat out there. He just didn't get his own way, didn't perform, finished last. So when you do that in Hong Kong in the stalls, you are sent for a barrier trial, which he had to do last Friday. So he passed that. He was much better out of the stalls. And John Moore, his trainer, is much more confident this time. He thinks they've sorted out a few issues. He was keeping his cards fairly close to his chest, though, with regard to what they were. But you'd have to take that as a massive positive that he's feeling very good going into it. The exact same happened actually last October at the very beginning of his season. It was basically a carbon copy of what happened last time out, and he put that behind him in style in his next two runs. This Sunday, he's got stall 5. The two on his immediate inside are both going to be dropped back. Hot King Prawn is in 1. Big Party is another one who's going to go forward in 2. But as long as he breaks like he should, I think he's going to lead them. I think I'd just give a little squeak to Tanks Forever as well, his stablemate. He's another John Moore horse with a few issues in the stalls. They've put blinkers on him in a piece of work there last week for the first time, and Moore was really confident that did the trick. His draws just probably killed his chances. He's out in 11. There's a good bit of pace in 10 and in 9 as well. So I think realistically, it's just all about a Tiro. It's a simple and tough one for me. If he breaks, he wins.
Best bet of the weekend, Connor?
A Tiro. So keen on him. I think he could be one of the most naturally talented horses in the world, like I said. And we might be about to see something special on Sunday morning.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
All right, lads, just two very quick questions from social media before we go. For you both, Paddy, we'll start with you. Jamie asks, one horse to look out for in the coming months?
The obvious one for me is Pinatubo. Like, I know it's short price and all that kind of stuff. It'll be interesting to see how Pinatubo does develop from last year, because obviously it looked so good. Other ones I'd like to keep an eye on is Batash. As a sprinter, he's going to be one of the favourites for all those big sprints, but looks so good. For like the King Stand and all that kind of thing. And then the other one is maybe if Goshen goes for some of the cup races, like Goshen, who fell in the Triumph, just look a runaway that doesn't stop, like the Ebor and things like that, he's favourite for. But I wonder, will he go for other kind of long distance races? And he could be one to keep an eye on if he's campaigning through the flat.
Ruby?
I think Paddy has pretty much mentioned what's obvious to people, but I think Build Me Up Buttercup dropped back a little bit and tripped on the flat for Willie. Could be a couple of big races in her.
Very good. Jonesy asks, Ruby, if you hadn't hosed up in the Punchestown Gold Cup last year on Kenboy, when would you have called it a day?
When Shaq and Bourgeois won the next day.
But that was the plan, ride a big winner in Punchestown and pack it.
Ride a great one. I obviously had won a Classic Dream the day before, but I wanted to ride in the Gold Cup. And from there on, the next Grade 1 winner I rode was going to be the one I bowed out on. Thankfully, I did it in 2019, because 2020 would have been a bit awkward, Tom.
If you didn't ride a great runner in Punchestown, you would have kept going through Galway and on into next season.
Yeah, I was rolling the dice, but I was lucky enough to work for Willie Mullins, and Willie Mullins in Punchestown, bar an injury, I think I was going to be lucky enough to ride a big winner.
Easy game.
Simple.
That's all we've got time for, folks. My thanks to our very own Bonnie and Clyde, Paddy and Ruby. Thanks to Jason Weaver. Thanks to Mike Joyce. And thanks to our very own international racing guru, Connor Murphy. But most of all, my thanks to you for listening. I've been Tom Nugent, and that has been From the Horse's Mouth.
From the Horse's Mouth is a Muddy Knees Media production for Paddy Power.